Paul Rudnick has joined us from New York City. His latest book is a, I think they call it juvenile fiction. I don't know why they do that. It used to be young adult. I will find out. It's called Gorgeous. It's a fable. And he's with us right now. And hi, Paul. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good. Yourself? Fine?
Cleared
that up. Okay.
There you go.
Yeah. Are you really good, or you just say that?
I'm really good. I'm back on your show. What more could a guy want?
I don't know. There must be something somewhere. And is this like your first? Is it called juvenile fiction?
Well, they've been redefining the genre in all sorts of strange new ways. It's generally called young adult, but because the publishers have found that there's been so much crossover because of the huge successes like Harry Potter and The Hunger Games, that it's a new genre called young adult, which sounds like a strange new form of cosmetic surgery.
Yeah.
But that's kind of where my book lands, because what I've found is that it's the heroine of the book is an 18-year-old girl, so that's why it made sense as young adult. But it's been crossing over to the adult market, which is I'm writing for everybody.
Yeah, but what it says in that ISBN thing, you know?
Yeah.
In the jacketed hardcover, 1, identity, psychology, juvenile fiction; 2, beauty, personal, juvenile fiction; 3, princess, juvenile fiction. Identities in parentheses there, and then
this
it says
is all going on my headstone. Especially the prince, juvenile princess, the Paul Rudnick story.
So you're saying it's young adult; it is not juvenile fiction.
Exactly.
What was your thinking in going? Were you trying to win over this market, this emerging market?
Well, it's funny. When I started writing it, the book originally was inspired by something my mom said, which this was a few years back, and it was actually a couple of months before she died. She was going through photos of herself as a young girl and a young woman, and she looked up at me, and she said, you know, back then, I used to think I was so ugly, but I looked great. And it was kind of a heartbreaking moment. And but then she left because she had this amazing sense of humor. But it got me thinking about appearance and about how all the physical side of things can rule our lives and how that can eventually catch up with you. So that was pretty much the spark. And I wasn't thinking in terms of whether this would even be a novel or a play or a movie or who knows. But once I started writing it in the voice of a young girl, of someone who was being bombarded with all these images of physical perfection and fashion and Kardashians, then it somehow made sense as young adult that I thought, okay, this is a book for those girls and for everybody else as well. But that's how it began.
Yeah. Do you think they will read it? I mean, it's very funny, and but it's kind of sophisticated in a sense. You think the Hunger Games girls are going to read this?
I've been getting letters, which has been very gratifying from 15-year-olds and younger, and they seem to get everything. I think that because we live in this age of just unbridled social media, it's pretty hard for anyone to miss anything. But yeah, and that's actually, I was especially happy because they felt that the voice felt true, that it was, they could relate. And I thought that, because that's the real danger of when you write in the voice of a character that's very far from your own experience. But ultimately, I felt shockingly close to an 18-year-old girl. Upsettingly close.
Yeah. It's pretty hard for anyone to miss anything. You want to stand by that statement?
I just always wonder about when parents put those filters on their kids' computers. I thought, don't they think their kids have friends?
Really?
You know, I think that it's...
Sure.
And that makes me jealous of young people. I think they have access to everything.
Yeah.
They can be warped in whole new ways.
Yeah. You know, it kind of reminds me of, giving advice to my daughter at one point. I have two daughters, and she was having a problem with the friends, you know, this friend's letting her down and so forth. I said, honey, you just have to know what you can get from a friend. You know a person and they go this far, and you won't get anything beyond that for them. And just sort of get used, accept what you can get from a particular friend. And she said, Dad, you're not a girl, and you're not now.
Ooh.
So, you know, for you to make this...
I hope you turned to her and said, and you're not going to college. And you're not getting a car.
Yeah. No, I just never said anything to her again about anything, you know.
That sounds fine.
I just said, what time are you going to be back after that,
Exactly.
Pretty much. So if you made that leap to this consciousness, that's pretty significant.
Yeah, well, I think always with teenagers, that's their most potent weapon is the I'm young and you're not,
yeah.
which is valid because it's kind of the only thing in their arsenal. They don't tend to have money. They don't have second homes. They don't have private planes, but they can always claim, you know what? I've got so much better skin than you do.
Yeah.
And you could always say, and how long is that going to last?
Yeah. But, you know, they don't say it. They say, you know, I'm breaking out again, and I take birth control pills for my complexion. I say, oh really?
Me too.
That's a good one. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, fine. Okay, if it's for your face, that's fine.
Right, exactly. But I'll just keep this GPS monitor underneath your skin.
Yeah. And this girl, Becky, and who becomes Rebecca, or is both, I guess, it's a very understanding portrayal of this girl and the situation and how relentlessly horrible being young in school can be, you know, because people are mean, apparently. I mean, they're really mean, terrible.
Well, because also they can be mean in a far more global way nowadays because of Facebook and because of tweeting, that there are so many more ways for teenagers to get at each other.
Yeah.
And although it still is astonishing because on the other hand, there's a certain pleasure in that, you know, all those teen moms, even though every teen mom seems to end up in prison or in hardcore porn, you know, it's still a goal that you want that every mistake you make broadcast as widely as possible.
Yeah. Do you watch that, Teen Mom?
I have and sometimes it's mesmerizing because especially in the early episodes when the 14-year-old first finds out she's pregnant, and there's usually a scene on the world's ugliest couch where she's sitting about 5 feet away from a very lumpy boy with bad skin and a few whiskers, and she kind of mumbles, you know, I'm going to have a baby, and there's a long, long pause, and then he sort of says, like a baby? and that's kind of the end of the discussion.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Then the girl breaks it to her parents, and the parents say, well, do you know what this means? You know, as if the girl had never seen a baby.
Yeah.
And that's it. So it's the most minimalist experience, you know? So that has its own kind of allure. But after a while, although I do love Farrah, the teen mom who's just made porn.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Where even though she had her entire family with her during the porn shoot, she still made that mild stab at saying, I never intended this to be released. You know, and you think, oh, why? Did you feel it was just another form of like a wedding video?
Yeah.
But so, yeah, I've had my teen mom moments. Although,
okay.
It's nothing compared to the finest reality show of all time, which was I Didn't Know I Was Pregnant.
Oh, I didn't see that one.
Oh, that has been on for years, and it's all about women who are not necessarily overweight, but they suddenly one day, usually in the bathroom of a fast food restaurant, give birth. And they are always shocked and stunned, as is the baby's father. So it's like every episode is the same joke with the same punchline,
but
it always works because there's always that moment where she says, you know, and I was on the toilet, and then I heard something crying. and you want kind of the whole studio audience to join in and all chant, and I didn't know I was pregnant. But it's just one of the finest uses of the reality medium, I feel.
Is that on Bravo? What is that on?
I don't know. I get confused in those sort of nether reaches of cable television.
Yeah. So they just thought it was a weight problem or something.
Yes, or sometimes it's a stomach ache. Like they always think, oh, I think I had some bad fish. And you think, someday your child will grow up and watch this. And we'll know that will solve the riddle, why is my nickname Bad Fish?
Yeah. Here's a little perch. Perch.
Exactly.
Come here, honey.
You know?
Oh, boy. Anyhow, the book. Is that a real show, or are you? This is
no. Yeah. No, this has been very popular for many years. It's it has a kind of dream quality.
I feel another juvenile fiction book coming here.
Well, you also, of course, want the first teenage male to appear on an episode of I Didn't Know I Was Pregnant.
Yeah.
You know, just as a new frontier.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Now, gorgeous. This Becky, they say, is a very sympathetic character, and most of all, I guess, because of the relationship with her mother. who is a huge woman at this point, living in the trailer. They're living in a trailer. But it's not, it, you know, that whole part is not played out for comedy at all, which I really enjoyed about this. You know, it was funny, but the comedy wasn't at their expense.
Oh, absolutely, because I think that would be certainly the easiest route, and yeah. I wanted it to have a real emotional core, even though the book is in many ways very comic. And it also has a strong and very emotional fantasy element, because her mom has been morbidly obese and has been in very poor health, and she leaves her daughter a gift, which is after the mom dies, the daughter finds a mysterious phone number, which she calls, and then within minutes she's in Manhattan and she's meeting a legendary and reclusive fashion designer named Tom Kelly, and he tells her, "I will make you 3 dresses, 1 red, 1 white, and 1 black, and if you wear them, you will become the most beautiful woman who's ever lived." So it's this extraordinary and supernatural offer, and it's also conceivably quite insulting and troublesome. But Becky says yes, and the book just flies from there, because I wanted the book to also have elements of stories like the Picture of Dorian Gray and right. even Sunset Boulevard a little bit, to have the sense of the uncanny and also the dangers of answered prayers, and plus the wild pleasures of answered prayers as well, because I think whenever anyone, male or female, at any age looks in the mirror, I think their first response is they can't quite tell what they're looking at, which has always fascinated me, that any time you think you know what you look like, you're wrong. And then you suddenly see a photo of yourself, and you either look surprisingly good, and you don't know where that came from, or you look monstrous.
Yeah.
But I thought, what if you actually looked in the mirror and saw everything you've ever dreamt of?
Yeah.
You know, what if you had that high, and what if it could last? So that just seemed very tempting. And there's, you know, there's kind of a Faust element to it of, okay, what are you willing to trade for that kind of power? And so that's one of the places the book goes.
So it's juvenile Faust fiction.
Yeah, in many ways.
Pretty much.
And it's also in a pop culture sense, because it's there. The world offers a whole new set of temptations nowadays. And what if you could satisfy every one of them? What if you could have every degree of fame and wealth and fashion and branding? You know, what would that destroy you, or would it make you the happiest girl on earth?
Yeah, and the most beautiful in the world.
Yeah.
It's a little Snow White in there. I mean, a lot of Snow White in here.
Yeah.
And but she's quite I sort of the part in the trailer and the school and all that stuff really gets to me, because I taught high school for a while. But the meanness that web page that they have.
Oh yeah, no, that's all too standard. That there's, I don't know if I can use all the correct words, but it's pretty. Or if you could fill in the rest, but it's a web page where all of the kids at a high school get to rank, especially all of the girls in that school,
right.
and talk about them in the most vicious and most intimate ways.
Yeah.
It's kind of the social media version of what used to be called slam books. When girls, I know they did this in my high school. You passed around a notebook, and without signing your name, you would describe every one of your classmates in the worst possible sense about their weight, their face, their skin, everything. And it's just, especially at that age, it's just so overwhelming to face that kind of constant criticism and bullying and very knowing attacks as well, people who know just which buttons to push.
Yeah, so that's the mean girls kind of thing.
The
slam books and all that. But this is really advanced, actually, and it's also wrong, but at the same time, it's also clever, because it's coming really from you.
Oh, well, thank you.
There's certain drawback. I mean, they really are slams, but they're so funny.
Oh, yeah, no, well.
And so unbelievably clever. And so is she, you know, because Becky is most of this is the first person, right?
Yep.
She's describing all this. And she's very funny, insightful, and sounds a lot like you.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, no, because I didn't want her to be whiny. I thought this has got to be a girl with some spirit to her who can really.
She's great.
But what was fun is that when you take all of these, because if you just write about the Hollywood, about landing on the cover of Vogue, about meeting the British royal family, that's fun. But it's much more fun if you write about it from the point of view of someone who's never been anywhere near that kind of stuff, who's experiencing it for the first time, and who's also a little skeptical, so that she can, you know, view it all from the eye of a typical American teenage girl.
Mm-hmm.
It just gives you a wonderful way in, rather than taking only the sort of more Jackie Collins view of things.
Yeah. Can I impose on you maybe to read a little from this? Would you mind doing it?
Sure. Hold on. Let me get my copy. Do you have a favorite section? What would you like me to read?
I sort of like the beginning when she comes in New York, and sees the big city for the first time and that whole shock value. But anything that you think would be kind of you'd like to read, I guess.
Okay. Well, although there's another chunk that I've read a couple of times, which is. Once Becky is transformed into the gorgeous and glorious Rebecca Randall, she gets to go everywhere, and she actually meets Prince Gregory, who's kind of a Prince Harry type, who she suddenly, there's a very real possibility that Becky may end up as the Queen of England. But anyway, so she starts dating Prince Gregory, and he invites her, as Rebecca, as this glorious creature, to an event in the British Museum. So this is basically their first date.
Okay.
There she is, said Prince Gregory, as I was presented to him in the huge central hall of the British Museum. Your Highness, I said, why are you laughing? I wasn't laughing. Yes, you were, although you tried to stop. So now you must tell me, what was so amusing? I had a choice. I could make up a convenient lie or just toss my hair, but when I saw the prince smiling at me, I took a risk. At the hospital, the prince had valued honesty, and he had a terrific sense of humor. So I decided that if I was going to spend any amount of time with the guy, let alone marry him within a very few months, I was going to sort of be myself. I'd look like Rebecca, but I dare to behave like Becky. I was laughing because where I grew up in the States, every guy dreams of being called Your Highness. My friend Rocher's stepfather sometimes pats his crotch and calls it King Rodney. The prince glared and then burst out laughing, insisting, you say the most impossible things. I'm sorry, it's just, I'm still not all that clear on royal protocol. I'm not sure if I should keep my head bowed when I'm around you, or stand a few steps behind you, or just pretend that you're a person. Well, I'm not at all sure how to behave around you. Should I try not to stare, or should I keep reminding myself that even if you're so beautiful, you might want to have a conversation? Or should I simply dissolve into a puddle of adoration at your feet? All right, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to pretend that you're a guy, and you're going to pretend that I'm a girl. Very good. So how are you? Do you live nearby? May I get you a drink? Are you hitting on me? Perhaps. Do you have a job? Anyway, that just gives you a taste of it.
That's very sweet. And I love the interview she gets with the Queen, eventually, the three questions from the Queen.
Oh, yes, because I'm just such an enormous Queen Elizabeth fan, so Queen Catherine is very much my tribute to her, and of course the corgis, her beloved dogs.
Yes, the many corgis, and the final question and all that, which is the winning question for her.
The one about do you want to hear that?
Would you do that? I think that's
sure.
That knocks me out.
All right.
Interview with the Queen for future daughter-in-law.
Yes, exactly. So, and the initial questions are more serious about who she would emulate as queen and why she feels she's qualified. But then there's one final question, and the corgis are very much sort of the jury with all these questions. All right, hold on. Let me see. Whoops. Wait a minute. All right, here we go. The queen says... Question number 3. For what is that expression? For all the marbles. You marry Prince Gregory. You become queen. Years pass. Despite your lasting and affectionate union, one morning you receive a tearful phone call from a close friend, and you discover that your beloved husband, King Gregory, is cheating on you. Who knows why? Who can say? Your beauty might have begun to fade imperceptibly. Perhaps your popularity exceeds his own. He's growing older and knows it and requires a diversion. Whatever the cause, there it is, in your lap. The corgis were eyeing me smugly, as if they'd known about the affair months before I did. If they had eyebrows, they were arching them. What do you do? Okay, then... Ultimately, she thinks about this. She goes through all sorts of convolutions, but then she finally decides. The queen says, your answer? if you discovered that our darling Gregory was unfaithful, I would wait until he was sound asleep, and then I would grab a rusty hunting knife, and I would carve out his heart and serve it to him for breakfast with hash browns and real maple syrup. And then I'd put on a clown suit with big shoes and one of those cardboard party hats with the elastic under the chin, and then I would sing the national anthem and eat an entire box of Malamars while I tap dance on his grave. There was a pause as the queen looked to her corgis, and vice versa. There was instantaneous and positive agreement. Welcome to the family, said the queen.
Welcome to the family.
Exactly. Oh, so that's how Becky gets the royal approval.
Yeah. And that's pretty much true, actually, when you consider the family.
Oh, yeah. My God, what that woman's put up with.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's so beyond the teen mom experience.
Yeah.
In
yeah.
terms of disappointing kids.
Now, and the whole the fashion angle of this now, Tom Kelly and such, I know that's not modeled on an actual designer, is it?
It's modeled on a whole batch of them. I think that it's a fairly recent historic phenomenon that designers have become pop cultural figures, and not just brand names, but kind of heroes in a sense. Everyone from the early days of the Calvin Kleins and the Ralph Laurens to now to Marc Jacobs and Karl Lagerfeld and the whole John Galliano mess. But that these guys are their own form of baseball cards. People know who they are, and people, you know, when any of these guys does a lower cost line at H&M, it sells out instantly, and there are crowds packing the streets. So so Tom Kelly was inspired by all those people,
all of them.
That phenomenon.
Savior by Tom Kelly, I like that.
Exactly, well, and that they all have those. Actually, one of my favorite insanities is whenever you look at fashion layouts in Vogue or Harper's Bazaar, they list the designer of the clothing being shown, and they list the fragrance the model is wearing. And you think, it's a photograph. There's no scratch and sniff.
Yeah.
But that people want, especially in those early days when they first started giving the high-end perfumes name like Poison by Yves Saint Laurent, you know, or the Urban Decay line of nail polishes, that people want things that sound fatal.
No, yeah. And you seem to have a fashion sense yourself. I mean, do you know something about the fashion world? Or are you a fashionista or into that?
Well, I'm sort of more of a fan than anything else. I have friends in that world, and one of my oldest and closest friends is a wonderful Broadway costume designer named William Ivy Long, who actually just won his sixth Tony Award this year.
Wow.
But he taught me about when I watched him in sittings with actors and actresses, and how you can make people who are very nervous suddenly very happy with how they look, and what that process is, and how a designer becomes a therapist and a parent and a policeman. You know that it's such a delicate moment when you're dressing someone. So I've kind of absorbed it through those roots.
Yeah, like that fitting she got where they took a drop of blood from her finger.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and just the whole idea of being measured in public is so humiliating. You know, it's even, I think, if you're an 8-foot-tall, 10-pound fashion model, you don't want anybody reading off those numbers. And that's what happens to Becky. So it's the kind of intensity of getting dressed, whether it's for a runway show or just, you know, in your bedroom in the morning. That's a very fraught moment.
Mm-hmm. And this is couture. I think that's what they said at that point.
The dresses are being made. That's the other thing. It's a real high. If anyone's ever had an outfit, whether it's, you know, home sewing or Tom Ford, when it's made just for you, it's suddenly you put it on and you realize the difference between JCPenney's and couture. That's a real high, and it's amazing. And it's very hard to go back. It's like the very few times I've been on private planes, it felt like that. You feel absolutely filthy. You feel completely immoral, and you can't wait to do it again.
Yes. I hate it when it's made for you and it doesn't fit. Isn't that? That's a bad feeling. You
know? Well, then you have to wonder, wait, I'm paying so much money for this. Am I allowed to complain or raise my hand? You know, because also fashion people can be very imperious. So if they don't want to change something, even if you're paying for it, it's hard to get them to come around.
Oh. So we're looking. So on the one hand, we're looking at fashion, but we're also looking at beauty.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's such, you know, and body image and all that stuff. And that's such, you know, it's such a big thing for young women, especially. You know, and it's a tough area to deal with, even.
Oh, yeah. No, it's kind of monumental because it seems very as if it's the definitive superficial area. But on the other hand, as long as there are mirrors in the world, there's going to be body image issues and a celebration of beauty and a terror of its opposite. So it just seems like it's very rich turf because it's something that everyone faces, even if they kind of claim, oh, I don't think about that stuff or I don't care what I look like. Everyone cares, and everyone has to get dressed in the morning so that it's, and you can either allow it to rule your life or destroy your life, or you can enjoy it. Because I wanted to go at it from both sides, that, oh, my God, we should never allow our physical appearance to dictate every other aspect of our lives and our self-worth. But there's also a kind of glory to beauty when you suddenly see someone, a man or a woman, and they just seem like another. Well, actually, I once worked on a movie where there was a very tall and glamorous movie star standing next to a rather short and squat one. And the short and squat one looked up at the glamour girl, and I heard her muttering under her breath, a different species, a different species. And it was true, that sense that they walk among us, but they're not us.
Yeah.
You know that they're, it's why you put a fashion model on the cover of a magazine, because it's a dream, and yes, that can be painful for everybody else, or you can just say, isn't that a gift from God?
Yeah.
You know, look at her.
It's a gift to some funny people. If you watch that runway show, which I do occasionally,
I must admit,
those girls are such idiots. I mean, I'm sorry, but they're completely almost knowledge-less, you know. They don't know anything about anything.
Well, they've usually been models since they were about 11, although when I first moved to New York and I was working as a messenger because I didn't have any money, and I was sent to a fashion agency to deliver a package, and there was a whole batch of models sitting in the sort of lobby area, and I was, because it was really cold outside because it was winter, I was wearing these gloves, fingerless gloves, these little wool gloves, where I cut off the fingers so I could still use my hands. And the models saw these gloves, and they loved them beyond belief. They were so impressed, and they were just oohing and aahing. And then one of the models turned to me, and she said, how did you do that? And I just wanted to hug her, you know.
Yeah, you wanted to.
And then when I said, you know, well, do you have a scissors at home? and I hope they're safety scissors. So there is... there is a certain perfection to a kind of model ignorance. Although I've also known models who are very bright. And
there
was one girl I knew who was wonderful. She was unbelievably beautiful, but she was smart. Mm. So she'd use it to see what she could get away with. Her whole goal in life, I think, was to see how outrageously could she behave before someone actually smacked her. but that was fun to watch because she made being that beautiful into kind of a sporting event.
Yeah, fantastic. It's a wonderful book, and you don't have to be juvenile to read this, or a young adult even. You can be an old adult like me and enjoy it. Paul Rudnick's gorgeous. Thanks, Paul, once again.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
As always, Paul Rudnick. Gorgeous is the book.